I want to begin by making a couple of observations for what they're worth. Some of you are old enough that you used to, and perhaps still do, subscribe to Reader's Digest for the jokes. I can remember, large print now, I can remember some years ago reading a story in Reader's Digest, I think, which seems to tie in with what Wanda talked about earlier this morning. The story was that there was an American airman who had been stationed in England during World War II. He had gotten to know the people of the little village close to the airbase. He had attended a church there, and when the war was over, that church had sustained some pretty serious damage. And so he gathered some money from friends of his, wherever he lived in the United States, maybe in the Midwest, and he sent money over to help finish up the work of rebuilding this church. And the church had a dedication service for the new, for the work having been completed. And they used the technology of the time to record the service. What was the technology of the time? It was vinyl records. They brought in a system and made a vinyl record. So they mailed him a vinyl record that had the recording of the service. He had that on his record player and was playing it, and he heard the vicar say in a prayer, "Lord, we thank you for this timely succor." Only he heard sucker. The record owner. So I was wondering who this timely succor was to help you with your group.
It's a wonderful opportunity.
I know, it's a timely succor. I just thought I would mention that this went through my mind. I don't know why. Number two, some of you have been to the worship service already this morning. Some of you have not. Okay. As soon as you get in, you will probably find a piece of paper that if you look down far enough, you will see a quote that will prepare you for this. There's a picture that a comment from Bob Dale talking about our church that says our church was born facing the world. Remember that? And Pastor talked about seeing a sign someplace that reminded him of something like this. And I thought I would just give you one more illustration. If you haven't been to church yet, just hang this when the time comes. Those of you who have been to church, you can go ahead and hang it now. We were on one of our two trips to Africa. We were leaving a place where the group had stayed overnight. We were the last car out, and we were about a mile away, maybe a mile and a half away, when the car quit. It just quit running. And the reason it had quit running was we had gone back to pick up something we had left behind, and the car, we had turned the car around in the road, had backed it into a hillside, and a small rock had been lodged in the tailpipe so that the engine could not blow out exhaust. That was the reason it quit. But we didn't know all this, so we were out there in the middle of the road. Bill Harrington was driving the car, and I remember getting out of the car. He was in the engine compartment thinking maybe there was a problem there, and I'm looking in the engine compartment with him, and he looked up at me and said, "Don't look at me." And I said, "What?" He says, "Don't look at me. You're supposed to be looking out. You're supposed to be watching for lions." So when you get to that point, sort of hang that as a third illustration of this particular thing. Okay. That's a true story. There probably is one more that I'm supposed to remember, but old age is getting to me. We are coming to the book of Judges. This is last week as we finish the book of Joshua. One of the things I tried to help you note was that in the book of Joshua, it was made clear that the process of preparing the promised land for the people of Israel was not ever completed. There were more people groups that needed to be displaced or dispossessed. I will say one more time, there's parts of that that I do not understand, but that I find troublesome, because it comes close to sounding like genocide. And I don't know how to make sense of that. But nevertheless, the process wasn't completed. And the only analogy I know to sort of help you understand what that means is the analogy of cancer. If some surgeon comes into your body to go after cancer, you want the surgeon to get it all. And if you don't get it all, you've got some problems. The first chapter and a half, maybe the first two and a half chapters, up through chapter 3, verse 6, is that story extended. There was some additional dispossessing, but not nearly all. Not nearly all. And so in Judges, you will see the ones that were finally dispossessed, and after all of that was done, the ones that still were not. If you look in chapter 1, verse 27, for example, Manasseh did not dispossess this place, nor this place, nor this place, nor this place, nor this place. In all those places, the Canaanites held their ground. That's verse 27. And it goes on and talks a bit past there. So there was left a lingering problem, a lingering group, and they were living alongside. Now, as we finished last week, I took you to Judges chapter 2, starting at verse 6, which is an echo of some things in the last two chapters of Joshua, with the exception that verse 10 is different. Verse 10 says, "And when that whole generation had been gathered to its ancestors, another generation followed it, which knew neither the Lord nor the deeds which he had done for the sake of Israel." Last time we talked about the question, how could that have been? Why didn't they know? And we spent some time talking about that. What I didn't mention and should have is that if you go to Exodus chapter 1, verse 8, I don't necessarily recommend you go there right now, but write it down. Exodus chapter 1, verse 8, it says, "There was a new generation that arose in Egypt who did not remember Joseph and all the things Joseph had done for Egypt." And the slavery of the people of Israel came as a consequence of that failure to remember. This seems to be a fairly common recurrence. So, today we begin the discussion of Judges, and I want to begin that discussion taking a look in verse 11 of chapter 2. So if you find chapter 2, verse 11, that's where we will begin. And what I want to do is try to help you understand what you're seeing in the next 5, 6, 7, 8 verses is a pattern that will set the pattern for the whole rest of the book. So I want to get that pattern in front of you. Verse 11, what's the first thing it says?
Amen.
Yes. What did they do? Mine says they did what is evil in the eyes of the Lord and served. Mine says the Baals. Yours may just say Baal. Okay? What had God said? God had said through Moses and then again through Joshua, you are going to be tempted to leave worshiping God and worship false gods, to serve false gods. When that happens, destruction is coming. So what's coming after verse 11? Destruction is coming. They deserted the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who had brought them out of Egypt. That's verse 12. And they followed other gods, gods from those of the surrounding peoples. They bowed down to these gods. They provoked the Lord. They deserted the Lord to serve Baal and Astartes. The Lord's anger grew hot against Israel. And now we're in the middle of verse 14. What did God do? My verb says handed them over. How does yours render that? Sold them to delivered them to their enemies. Okay? Mine says handed them over to pillagers who plundered them.
Raiders.
Yours says raiders.
Marauders.
Sounds like pieces of the Old West. And if you don't think that's still happening today, then you're sheltered. And if you don't think that could happen here, I think you're sheltered. This is ugly and hard. What did the people do? He handed them over to pillagers who plundered them. He delivered them to the enemies surrounding them. They were no longer able to resist their enemies. Whenever they mounted an expedition, the Lord's hand was there to foil them, as the Lord had told them and as the Lord had sworn to them, so that they were in dire distress. Okay, what's the first step in the pattern? The people begin to do things that God has said those are things that people should not do. God has defined those things as evil. What's the number one thing they did? Began to worship and serve other gods. What's the second step in the process? God gets mad. What's the third step in the process? If you go to Isaiah chapter 5, you'll find a section in there that talks about a vineyard. And it talks about that vineyard having been carefully protected by the landowner with hedges and barriers to protect that vineyard. And it talks about the landowner getting so upset and so mad at that vineyard for the kind of grapes it produced that he took away the hedge of protection. And then at the end, Isaiah says, the vineyard is the nation of Israel and God is the vine, the landowner. The sense you have here is God is in response. The word that's used is anger, but I think that may not say it correctly for our ears. To say God allows the consequences to fall rather than protecting people to give them time. He takes away the hedge of protection, and here come the marauders. And they are in misery. Mine uses the phrase at the end of verse 15, they were in dire distress. What does yours say at the end of 15? Very distressed, your sister. Okay? Now, what is missing here, and I could wish the Bible writer had put it in here. He sure puts it in later places. Is there is a response of the people that is not given here. And the response of the people is pretty predictable. What did they do? They began to pray to God. God, we're under such trouble here. Don't you notice? Don't you care? Aren't you going to do something about it? Verse 16. What did he do? That's remember, what I just said is missing. There's four parts to this. The people do what is evil. They begin especially to worship and serve other gods. God allows the consequences to fall. Their protection is taken away. They begin to be in dire distress. The third thing, which is not in this first little bit, is the people cry out to God for help. And now what's the fourth part? God raises up, and their specific word is used, which is the word for the book. The word in my translation is judges. Is that the word used in yours? Okay. Raised, he appointed them judges who did what? Mine says rescued them. What is saved them from the hands of their plunderers. Mine is going back to pick up that word, the pillagers who plundered them. Okay? Let's make sure we see the pattern. How does the pattern start? People begin to pay no attention to the law. They become disobedient. They become rebellious. And it culminates in they worship other gods and serve other gods instead of serving the Lord Himself. What's the next phase? The hedge of protection is taken away. The marauders and the plunderers come in. Military powers come in and overrun them. What's the third step, which remember is missing here? They pray to God, they call out to God, they cry out to God. God hears, and God responds by raising up judges. And what do the judges do? They deliver the people from that particular oppression. And what happens in verse 17? Let me just finish this little bit. What happens in verse 17? They do it again. They do it again. And what you have is a cycle upon a cycle upon a cycle upon a cycle, and that's the story of Judges. Now.
Well, I was just going to say, it's interesting the way this is a CED version, Common English version.
Yeah.
It says, the Lord raised up leaders to rescue them from the power of the Lord. Or the NIV says, like it was done in the past tense. This looks like it's the purpose of them is to do this, but then it persists.
Yeah.
They didn't obey.
If you follow the pattern, what actually seems to happen more often than not is an echo of what we just read in chapter 2, verse 10, and what we remembered from Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. What did chapter 2, verse 10 say? There rose up another generation who didn't know the Lord, didn't know the deeds they'd done for Him. Right? Why not? Well, you can speculate all day on that one. And what's the consequence? The consequence is this sort of stuff happens. So what happens is, more often than not, as long as that judge is alive, as long as that judge or that group of judges, sometimes it's more than one, as long as they are providing or that one is providing leadership, then things are good. People remember the Lord, they serve the Lord because the leader is leading them to. But when that person dies, what happens? Another generation comes along that knows nothing about the Lord. And what happens? They fall right back into that cycle again. I like the difference of the... This translation says the judge... My translation says the judges who rescued them, as opposed to your suggesting...
Lord raised up leaders to rescue
them. And what I'm going to pull out of that is it's God who's rescuing them, but he's using human instruments as part of that process. It's not the judges who are rescuing them, but God working through the judges. And I think that's an important distinction, and your translation comes closer to bringing that out, I think.
It makes it clear that there's still something that has to happen on behalf from the people's part in order for that to happen. They're there, but the people have to access it.
Verse 17, even to their judges they refused to listen. You can almost say it's either that or they refused to listen for a very long time. They only listened for a short time, and then they fell back into things again. Now, it's very interesting in verse 17. There's a very powerful verb that's used in my translation in the middle of verse 17, right after what we just read. Mine says they prostituted themselves. That is an image that goes through the whole of the Old Testament. It is picked up a little bit in the New Testament. The picture of fidelity in marriage being thrown away by prostitution. And the picture of the relationship of God to his people as a husband and wife, and faithfulness or not faithfulness being a part of that. The picture in the New Testament of the church as the bride of Christ is an echo of this old idea. They prostituted themselves to other gods and bowed down before these. Very quickly they left the path which their ancestors had trodden in obedience to the orders of the Lord. They did not follow their example. When the Lord appointed judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and rescued them from the hands of their enemies as long as that judge lived. That's the phrase I want you to see. This, to me, is a summary of the book. This is not, I think, speaking of one particular episode. It's speaking to the pattern of episodes that are coming. And the historian is giving you what we in our trade would call an abstract of the full story. Okay? The Lord was with the judge, middle of verse 18, and rescued them from the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived, since the Lord relented at their groans unto their persecutors and oppressors. But once the judge was dead, they... What's your verb?
Returned,
yours says. Mine says relapsed. Remember what we said last time? You can't relapse if you haven't already lapsed. There is a pattern here. It's lapse and relapse and relapse and relapse. Yours says corrupted again. They relapsed into even worse corruption than their ancestors. They followed other gods. They served them and bowed before them and would not give up the practices and stubborn ways of their ancestors at all. And you can feel the cycle starting again. Okay?
Well, they didn't wipe out those Canaanites, so therefore they're going to be intermingling, and that's what God wanted them to do. To wipe them out so they wouldn't have this.
And the next 10 or 12 verses going down to verse 6 of chapter 3 begins to make it explicit. God has now chosen to leave some people among them to provide. The people seem to want this. There's a statement somebody said one time that you can say no to God long enough and then God says okay to you. If you look back in Genesis when Pharaoh was talking to Moses, it says early on, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Pharaoh hardened his heart. You remember what happened after a while? God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Remember that? The picture you have is God said, okay, I'm going to quit clearing these people out. You don't seem to want them cleared out. You seem to want to be dealing with them. After a while, I'll let it be. And that's awful. That's awful. Sources of infection, so to speak, were left in place. And that's what down through chapter 3, verse 6 is talking about. Do you have any questions or comments so far? I have just summarized the book. a teacher who is on a deadline might say, let's just skip to Ruth right now. But I do have a small observation. I have gone through the remainder of the book, and I've outlined it for you. It's up on the board. I have counted the number of judges who are named in this book. I was stunned. I'd never done this before. There's 12 of them. But there's 13 if you count the ones that there's two of. Isn't that interesting? Those of you who know something about Manasseh and Ephraim and Joseph. Okay. There's 12 of these. Now, what I'd like you to do for just a moment, and I do want you to turn to this one. I want you to turn to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. As you're turning there, this is my chance to let star pupils shine. Do you know the subject of Hebrews chapter 11? It's the heroes of faith, the roll call of faith chapter, right? Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32, I think I have the right verse. Would you please tell me who is named in that verse? There should be five people named. The fifth one is David. I'm looking for the first four.
Gideon.
Hold on, slow down. Who's the first one?
Gideon.
Who's the second one?
Barak.
Who?
Barak.
B-A-R-A-K. I missed it. I was trying to make sure you weren't going to confuse this with the ones that we talked about before, the two names that were so funny. What were the two names?
Balaam
and Balak. It is Barak in this case. And there's another person mentioned, I think.
Samson.
So this one is mentioned. Somehow they don't mention Deborah.
Yep.
The only woman that's in the list, they do mention Barak. Okay. Barak, Gideon, Barak, who's next?
Jephthah,
that's this one. And?
Samson,
that's this one.
David.
And then they mention David, who's not in this book. That's David is much, much later. What does it say of those four?
I've run out of time if I told you about all these people.
You do have an interesting translation, don't you? There's not enough time. Mine says, yours says, I've run out of time.
I would run out of time if I told you that.
Oh, that's good. I would run out of time if. Okay. Mine just says there's not time to talk about this. Now, what does that tell us? That tells us as we're going through Judges, we might want to spend more time talking about those four. Those seem to be the four that sort of rise up. You might notice this one is two chapters long. How long is this one? One verse. Shamgar gets a verse, and Gideon gets almost three chapters. The Bible is sort of hinting at this. How much does this one get? This is Tola.
Two
verses. How about Jer?
Two verses.
Three verses. Count again. Three, four, five.
Okay.
Jephthah gets about two chapters by the time you get through. Chapter 10, chapter 11. Most of chapter 10, all of chapter 11, a little bit of 12. Okay. Ibzan is only three. There's a friend of mine who graduated from Elon College. I'm assuming there's a name that came from here somehow or another, but Elon only gets two verses. So as we look through, we're going to see these. Now, you notice, in addition to the judges, the outline has three more things. What are those three more things? What have I called them? Interludes. What's an interlude? A little break that comes in between. Okay? Who's the subject of the first such break? Abimelech. He gets a whole chapter. There's two more down here that I haven't told you who they're about because they're not about a person who is named. They're about, it's a little more complicated than that. This one's two chapters, and this one's three chapters. There's some other pieces that are in here. But we're going to spend most of our focus talking about those four.
Hey, Bill, I've got a question. I might be off base. You said, I'm looking at Hebrews chapter 11.
I'm hoping you're looking at Hebrews 11. I'm hoping verse 32 is the verse you're supposed to look at. Most of you seem to find what I thought you would find in that verse.
Mine doesn't tie in with what you're talking about up there.
Does it say, I don't have time to tell you about?
Abimelech.
Yeah. And who's the first one you don't have time to tell you about?
Gideon.
That's this one.
Yeah.
And who's the second one?
Right.
And that's this one. Yeah. And who's the third one? That's this one. And who's the fourth one?
J-U-T-S.
Yep. And then it names David, who's off in another part of town. All I'm saying is, if you look at Hebrews, Hebrews says there's four of these that rise to where there's something special about those four. And if you look, what I'm saying is, if you look, those are also the ones, for the most part, that are pretty long. That they can give you several chapters. That's all I'm saying. If you want to know, in the rest of this, where should you put your attention? My suggestion is, you might want to put your attention on these four. These are the ones that say.
Samuel.
Yeah, that's much. That's much later.
Right on.
That's later. That's later. Well, that's page two. Okay. If you'll take a look at chapter 3, verse 7, I want to look briefly at Othniel.
Are we in Judges now?
I'm in Judges chapter 3. And I do want to look briefly at Othniel. I'm trying to remember, was it in Charlie Brown? Was it in Peanuts that the teacher was Miss Othmar? Is that right?
Yeah.
Calvin and Hobbes, it was Ms. Wormwood, I think. I think that's right. The Othmar comes pretty close to this. Verse 7, how does it start? They did what is evil in the Lord's eyes. What's the second thing it says? They forgot the Lord and served Baals and Ashtoreths. The Lord's anger blazed out about them. He handed them over to so-and-so, the king of Edom. And the Israelites were enslaved to so-and-so for 8 years. So-and-so is how you can get around trying to pronounce something you don't know how to pronounce. I highly recommend that technique. Verse 9, what was the response of the people of Israel? That was what was missing in the summary back above, but that's what's present in most of these. They cried out to the Lord, and he raised. Mine doesn't say the word judge here. It's got a different word. Does yours still say? Yours says deliverer. That's what mine says. Who rescued them? Othniel, son of Kenaz. And who was Kenaz? Caleb's younger brother. Who was Caleb? He and Joshua were the two spies way back who brought the good report. And who were the only ones of that early group who were allowed to come into the promised land. Caleb and Joshua were the lead. So this was one of the. This was a son, a grandson, a great grandson out of one of the leading families, if you will. And what does it say about him? He was Caleb's younger brother. He was the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. So that means he was Caleb's nephew, right? And what does it say about him? The Spirit of the Lord was on him. In him, yours says. On him, mine says. Upon him, on him, in him. In Acts, for the first time, the Spirit of the Lord came on everybody. But before that time, the Spirit of the Lord would come on one here, one here, one here. That's another theme. What seems to be special about the judges were that they were ones through whom God could work, and God worked by bringing His Spirit alive in them. He became judge in Israel and set out for war. The Lord delivered so-and-so, king of Edom, into his hands. He triumphed over so-and-so. The country then had peace for
40 years.
40 years. And Othniel then died. And without looking, what happens next? The cycle starts again. The cycle starts again. The Israelites began doing what was evil in the Lord's eyes. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel, since they were doing what is evil in the Lord's eyes. Eglon, in connection with the sons of Amnon and Amalek, marched on Israel, beat them, and captured the city of palm trees. The Israelites were enslaved to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. Now, I don't necessarily recommend the last part, but if you happen to have teenagers that aren't interested in the Bible, this is a section that might catch them. Because when you start to read a little more carefully, what you find is this particular deliverer came to this king. You had a fat king and you had a short knife. He plunges the knife into the king. The king's belly fat was so big it, quote, closed over the knife. Are you down to that part?
Yeah.
He sneaked out through the I'm looking at verse 23. Chapter 3, verse 23. Ehud, that's the deliverer, went out through the privies. What's the privies? The bathroom. Having shut and bolted the doors of the upstairs room behind him. He was with the king in the bathroom and he locked the doors from the inside and then he went out through the window. Which left the servants wondering, what? Does the king have gastro distress? Should we just leave him alone for a little longer? As I say, that beats some of the video games I've seen. I do want to point out to you verse 24. There's a very interesting phrase, and just in case you don't know what this phrase means, I'll take a moment to help you understand it. When he had gone, the servants came back and looked. The doors of the upstairs room were bolted. I'm looking at verse 24. Are you finding this in verse 24? They thought he is probably, mine says, covering his feet in the inner part of the cool room. That's a cool room. Mine says covering his feet, and that is an accurate translation of those words. It is a literal translation of those words. Yours gives the sense. What does it say?
Relieving himself.
Mine has a footnote that says covering his feet means to relieve nature. I don't think that does a whole lot better. But I will tell you, in Scripture, when you see so-and-so is covering their feet, especially in King James, this is what it almost always means. And there are places where when it means that, it's strange. And I thought I'd just let you know what it means when you find it. Okay? Verse 26, Ehud got away, passed by the idols. That's capitalized in mine. Must have been some big false idols, images that the King Eglon had put up. Made good his escape to safety. Sounded the horn and then brought the soldiers back in and they defeated Moab because their leader was gone. How long did they have peace? Verse 30?
40.
I don't think. Mine doesn't say 40. Mine says 80. Mine says 80 years. Verse 31, after him came Shamgar. He took out 600 Philistines. He too was a deliverer of Israel. So what comes next? Chapter 4, verse 1. Chapter 4, verse... Can you see the cycles coming and going? Can you see the hopelessness of these cycles? Can you understand that this went on for year after year after year after year? And at the tail end of all this going on, with the cycle still going on in the background, you have the story of Ruth. And what comes in the story of Ruth? A baby is born whose grandson is going to be the fifth one in that list. David, I think, is there because of the tie back through Ruth. The tie back through Ruth. A baby is born. And the baby is not the one, but the baby is the one preparing for the one who would finally unite and become the first king. You noticed that, huh? We're still seeing this pattern today. If you are not walking out with that thought, then I have failed as a teacher. This is not something old and gone. This is something right now, right here. This is something right now, right here. There is a There is a phrase in one of Paul's letters that says, and greed, which is the same as idolatry. That's loose in our world. Okay? Chapter 4, verse 1, Ehud was dead. The Israelites began doing what is evil in the Lord's eyes. The Lord handed them over to Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, or Sisera, we don't know how to pronounce that, who lived in a certain place whose name starts with H. Don't even try. Verse 3, this is the third step of the cycle. What's the third step? They cried out. But now, mine says they cried out for a reason. What was their reason? Stay in verse 3. Mine has the reason in verse 3. Mine says, the Israelites then cried to the Lord for Jabin's army. Who was the army commander? Sisera. Had 900 iron chariots and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. 20 years is a long time, folks. So who did he raise up? What does the next verse say? It doesn't say he raised up Deborah. It says something more fundamental. Mine says Deborah, a prophetess, wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at the time. Now that's fascinating. It doesn't speak of her as being raised up for this purpose. It speaks of her as already being in place. Yours says leading. Mine uses the word judging at that spot. She used to sit at a certain place that even took her name. It was so famous. Mine says it was Deborah's Palm. And it tells you where it was, between Ramah and Bethel in the highlands of Ephraim. And the Israelites would come to her for justice. Some judges seem to have the function of judging. Some judges didn't. Samson wasn't much of a judge in that sense. But he was a judge, a deliverer in the larger sense. Verse 6, she sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, has not the Lord your God, the God of Israel, commanded, go march on Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 of the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. I will entice Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, to encounter you at the torrent of Kishon with his chariots and troops, and I will put him into your power. Has not God says this, she says to Barak. Barak's response is fascinating. There is an echo here of something much, much earlier involving Moses and God. What does Barak say? I'll go if you'll go along. I want you with me. Moses says, don't go. Don't send me someplace that you're not going to go with me. That's what Barak says. She says to Barak, if I go with you, you're not going to get the credit. What does Barak say? I'm paraphrasing here. I don't care. If you don't go, I'm not going. Verse 9. I'll go with you then, but the way you're going about it, the glory is not going to be yours. For the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of horrors. A woman. And you can almost hear Barak saying, fine with me. Fine with me. Deborah is God's person in that place. Barak has enough insight to know that, and he's no fool. I find Barak fascinating, and they tell me almost nothing about him. Because that's about it. It begins to talk about Sisera, begins to talk about the things. Here's another little video moment. How does Sisera end up? Somehow they negate those chariots. He's now running for his life. He hides in a tent of a wife of somebody that he knows is sort of neutral. And while he's under the rug hiding away, she puts a tent peg through his... These are not kind and gentle moments. Did you get to that point? You've read this already, right? This was your assignment, was to read this. Okay? You remember what Moses did when the armies of the Egyptians were destroyed in the Red Sea? He recorded a song. So did Deborah. It's Deborah's song, not Balak's, not Barak's song. And that's chapter 5. That's chapter 5. Some parts of it are rough, some parts of it are gentle, but it's there. Now, there is not time to tell you all about Gideon today. So we're going to stop at this point. Let me go back and review for just a moment. What's the key verse early in this book? Chapter 2, verse 10. What does it say? A new generation arises which didn't remember. And all kinds of tragedy came from that. Right? What was the pattern of that tragedy? They quit obeying God's law. They quit worshiping and serving the Lord. They began to worship and serve false gods, the gods of the people around them. I want to be just like everybody else. That's a very dangerous phrase. I want to be just like everybody else. The pastor talked about ads for Coke Zero. There's an ad for Dr. Pepper. Have you seen that ad? He rips off his shirt, and underneath it says, oh, you haven't seen this ad yet?
Yeah.
It's a red shirt with white letters. There's one, two, three of you that have red shirts today, right? Remember what it says? I'm one of a kind. And within seconds, what happens? There's 1,000 of him running around in the streets. I'm one of a kind. There's 1,000 just like me. No. Being just like everybody else. That's dangerous. They begin to serve other gods. God removes his hedge of protection. The hard times come. And what happens then?
They cry
out to God for mercy and for help. And what does God do? Raises up someone who, on whom God's Spirit rests, in whom God's Spirit is active, and that person becomes a leader, a deliverer. And as long as that person is alive, the people serve God and serve God faithfully. But when that person dies, what happens? Another generation comes up. This is arguably the saddest book in the whole of the Bible. Because through the whole of the book, the pattern never breaks. And I think an argument could be made the pattern hasn't broken to this day. That's something to contemplate. But what book follows? The book of Ruth. So against the background of all this recurring misery, a little baby is born to the most unusual and unexpected parents. And through that little baby, two or three generations down the line, God is going to raise up somebody that he describes as a man after my own heart. And the things we can learn from that person are out there to be learned. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
Was it a gradual thing after the judges died and the people just didn't immediately start worshiping Baal? Wasn't it a sort of gradually as those who were worshiping God died out?
Can I take it from wasn't to isn't? No. Don't look back then. Look now. Is it gradual or is it immediate?
It's gradual.
It's gradual. You start to neglect. You start not to worry. If you want to see it best, over in the book, one of the two books of Kings, there's a section where one of the kings decides to clean up the temple. In the cleaning up of the temple, they find a book. It's a book that nobody has ever read. And they start reading the book and they say, oh my goodness, what is this? We're not doing any of this stuff. It turns out the book of the law has never been read inside God's temple. God's temple is there. But the worship of God isn't taking place. And when you start listing all the things he cleans out, all the things that were going on, it's a horror list. That's what was happening inside the temple, on the temple grounds. It's amazing. It's just amazing. So, yes, I think it's gradual. But perceptive people can still see it. That's enough for this morning. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, the thing that moves us and the thing that concerns us is that we might be beginning to realize this isn't a pattern that was way back then. It's a pattern that's here and now. And so I pray for this people, for this group, that you would begin to open our eyes to see things the way you see them, more and more so that we can begin to understand what we can do, because you are in the business of calling out individuals to make a difference. Help us understand the difference we're supposed to make, the difference we could make if your Spirit was alive inside of us and if we were fully responsive to the moving of that Spirit. So I pray that your Spirit would be alive in each one of us and that we would each one be responsive. For even a small group can make a big difference when you're involved. All this we pray in your Son's name.